The 2005 Sunstone Symposium presents session number 301, a devotional session. Turning Hearts is about much more than genealogy, being atonement in the world, by Jody England Hansen.
I'd like to welcome you to Sunstone. This is session 301, Saturday morning. And I have the privilege of introducing to you our speaker. And I left my notes at my chair.
You can move that.
Okay, our speaker today, this morning, is Jody England Hansen. She is an artist and bookmaker and writer, married to Michael, mother of Charlotte, Anna, and Joseph. And this is what she has written about herself. I have been fortunate in my life. I am one of six unique and diverse children of two amazing parents who were very teachable. That's interesting to say by your parents. Every difficulty that comes with being a part of a family of strong, opinionated individuals has been overshadowed by amazing experiences and the love and commitments we share. Now I am creating that with the strong, opinionated individuals I currently live with, my husband Michael and my three teenagers, Charlotte, Anna, and Joseph. We live in Farmington, Utah. I am a book artist and I teach art and creativity classes to all ages. Here's Jody.
I really would love it if you moved up. It would be just fine with me. I might be taking these on and off. It depends on the time of day as to when I need them right now. So we'll try the glasses at first. Good morning. This paper is called Turning Hearts. Turning Hearts is much more than a genealogy scripture, being at one-ment in the world. It is the last verse in the Old Testament, the earliest section of the Doctrine and Covenants. It appears at least five times in modern scripture, and it is usually referred to as the temple work and genealogy scripture. One version is in Doctrine and Covenants, section 2, given to Joseph Smith by the angel Moroni. Behold, I will reveal unto you the priesthood by the hand of Elijah the prophet, before the coming of the great and dreadful day of the Lord. And he shall plant in the hearts of the children the promises made to the fathers, and the hearts of the children shall turn to their fathers. If it were not so, the whole earth would be utterly wasted at his coming. In section 110:15, when Elijah appeared to Joseph in the Kirtland Temple, the verse reads, to turn the hearts of the fathers to the children, and the children to the fathers, lest the whole earth be smitten with a curse. Wasted, smitten, curse. In 128:15, it refers to Elijah turning the heart, single, of the fathers to the children, and the heart of the children to the fathers, lest I come and smite the earth with a curse. So again, a curse. This section, both leading up to and following verse 15, speaks of the relationship between living and dead. And here Joseph Smith speaks of the importance of baptism for the dead being the subject of the welding link between generations. He then gives full expression to his amazement and joy in the gospel, the good news, sharing a number of examples of many generations of prophets appearing and turning their heart to us to bring us that good news. What is the curse that will smite the earth, or how will the earth be utterly wasted at the second coming if temple work is not done? Is the act of filling out names on a group sheet and performing ordinances vicariously for them the means of protecting the earth? And how is baptism and temple work a welding link between generations? I ask you to consider these questions and how they can lead us to living the atonement by being at one. Baptism is a covenant and a promise to be a part of the gospel family. Take on the name of Christ. Bear one another's burdens and mourn with those that mourn. Every part of the covenant calls for us to be connected with everyone. A promise to share and lighten burdens can apply to opportunities at all times and anywhere on earth. Becoming a part of the family of Christ is anything but exclusive. His works, words, and grace are extended to all. Our recognition, acceptance, and declaration of our place in a family that everyone already belongs to is a way we can acknowledge the connection we have there already. Until we do acknowledge the connection, it cannot exist in any way for us personally. Baptism and other ordinances are opportunities to acknowledge those connections. We know the ordinance itself does not guarantee acceptance. It is an invitation that may or may not be accepted. Is there a scoreboard somewhere that keeps track of how many names someone has found, taken on vicariously, and had accepted? And I don't think it works that way, even though I know there are some who really wish it did. Not even temple work can buy your way into heaven. And yet how quickly we become human doings rather than human beings. We each yearn for our own personal list of what we need to do, when, and how many times to be guaranteed our reward, our salvation. And this is these verses are easy to go there. It is a short step from there to condemning anyone who is not doing what we are sure is the right thing, including condemning ourselves for never quite measuring up. Christ taught in the Sermon on the Mount that the life that produces results that last is a life of being rather than doing. What is it that we are committed to? What is it that we want to create in the world? If my commitment is mercy, I will be a merciful being now. A merciful being takes on the actions of mercy and creates the results of mercy. Blessed are the merciful, for they shall obtain mercy. No doing there, no having there, it's being. We can create our life from our commitment, not from a to-do list. The Turning Heart Scriptures ask us to take on a commitment to be one, to be connected. From that commitment, we take action. The action of genealogy and temple work is one of the ways to create connection across generations of time and space. And I praise and acknowledge all those who have done and continue to do genealogy and temple work. It has been a way that I have come to know and love many of my and my husband's direct relations that I did not meet in this life. My children have learned from the journals of others the things that they might not learn from me. I am also grateful for the work that makes it possible for me to know of and be connected to those I am not directly related to. Those who research and publish the histories of people from many different times and cultures offer me the opportunity of seeing and acknowledge the infinite ways of being connected with God. When I go to the temple for my commitment of being connected, the number is insignificant. I am not worried about my work being accepted. I take on those names and I become that person, even for a moment. That creates connection that will always exist. And then I am not alone. Neither are those who have died. We are saved from aloneness and invited to at-one-ment. What is the curse that will smite the earth if hearts are not turned? Are those who don't do temple work cursed? Of course not. I don't think there is a cursed power station out there waiting to blast anyone. And I don't think anything has greater destructive power or greater creative power than our own choices. The actions we take out of being committed to connection, whether it be temple work or volunteering to provide medical help to AIDS patients in Africa, only make a difference to us if they come from our commitment, if we choose them. I am the only one who can choose what I am committed to. I don't have to choose to be connected or to be at one, and yet with each choice comes results or consequences. Here are some things I have seen about relationships and being connected. We humans tend to be on guard about being in a relationship on any level. We are concerned that we will get hurt, and so we feel the need to protect ourselves. This happens at all levels of society. Nations require treaties, conferences, and massive militaries before they will have open relations with another nation. And even then, the borders are closed and guarded. Corporations have entire teams of lawyers to outline any agreements or transactions with others. There are laws that will protect couples, most couples, who are married or living together from risk of loss when the relationship ends. Peer groups might have certain ways of dressing and speaking to keep everyone safe and acceptable. When you get around toddlers, you have the experience of unconditional connectedness. There are no barriers with toddlers. We as humans love the concept of being unified, of being one, especially if it means that everyone else will finally get it right and become one with our way of thinking, which, of course, must be the right way of thinking. We tend to think that will happen if we set the right conditions for being connected. So we build barriers to protect us in our attempts at oneness. What we end up with is being separate, alone, and protected, claiming that we really want to be part of everyone. And I think that is the curse. We live a lie, and it pulls life from us. And the curse of the lie can smite in a moment. And here is an example. I love my husband, Michael, so much I can hardly stand it. We have a wonderful marriage that continues to become more amazing every day. In a matter of moments, he can go to me from being the most amazing, loving, sexy man to being the biggest jerk in the world. I can hardly stand talking to him. So an example of how that can happen is about a year and a half ago for Valentine's Day, we were involved in our children's swim meet, and we knew we weren't going to have a chance to have a date or any time together, and so he was going to be home for about 20 minutes before we went to the meet. So I made a huge Valentine's banner, and I covered the garage door with it, so when he'd come home, he'd see this, and it would be kind of this moment together for Valentine's Day before we rushed off to the meet and were with our kids, and then he was leaving town the next day and on business. And so he came home and he loved it. He thought it was great, and we rushed off to the meet, and it was up overnight. And the next morning, we were getting ready for him to go, and I went outside and the banner was gone. And I went and I said, "What happened to the banner?" And he said, "Oh, I took it down. I took care of it for you." I said, "Well, where is it?" And he said, "Oh, well, I threw it away." So immediately I had gone from, "I love this man, I'm so fortunate to be married to him," to, "What an idiot. Why would he do that?" And I was that banner that he had dumped in that garbage can. It's like, that is what I was saying. And I was going, "He doesn't appreciate me, he never has, he never will. He should be on his knees telling me that I am right to be upset. Please forgive him." Well, here's the ultimate lie during times like this. I think that I am so right about what is making me upset that I could practically look up in the sky and see a planet that has always been there, always will be, and the name of the planet is Jody is right, everyone else is wrong. So I get all the justification I need to be upset. Here's what it costs me. It costs me being able to express love to Michael and me being able to see how much he loves me. He took the banner down because he was going out of town and didn't want me to have to worry about cleaning it off the door. I wasn't willing to consider that. So I go from being loved and connected to being alone and upset in a moment, all because I want to protect myself and be right. In the moment, I can also choose to see what was going on with him. When I do, I have space for the way he was expressing love to me and be at one with him again. My self-imposed curse can be lifted quickly. This is a fairly minor, though common, example of choosing to be right rather than be connected. But this same process is what is behind almost every divorce, family rift, divided nation, civil war, and global warfare. In our home, we consider war to be a three-letter acronym for "We Are Right." This process is definitely what is behind the terror attacks. People will fly planes into buildings to prove they are right. Our response to them, hundreds of billions of dollars, hundreds of thousands of lives to prove we are right. An unwillingness to look at how we are all connected, but instead putting vast resources into convincing the world that we are right, and then protecting ourselves from the world we are trying to convince. This is the curse that smites the earth. God constantly invites us to be loved, connected, together, to be one. Why? Because it is just how it works. Being one brings us to Godhood, all of us connected through God, one eternal community of diverse, thriving, infinitely precious beings, individual and interacting, acknowledging and forgiving each other for everything each is and is not. Can we see this as a life of endless possibility, or do we turn to our fears that communities might limit and restrict us, demand that we give up our individual natures and opinions, cramming us into spaces that are physically and spiritually far too small? We are so sure this will happen that we feel diminished whether we try to connect with others or not. We create what we are most afraid of. This is evident when we remove ourselves from a relationship, a marriage, a job, a school, a church, a neighborhood. But we continue to blame problems in life on that relationship we have left. How can we be a part of something without giving up part of ourselves? God shows us how. In 2 Nephi 26:33, He inviteth them all to come unto Him and partake of His goodness, and He denieth none that come unto Him, black and white, bond and free, male and female, and He remembereth the heathen, and all are alike unto God, both Jew and Gentile. Nowhere does it say He inviteth all and all will be assimilated, or only if they all agree with each other and look the same. Nowhere does God have to give up any part of Godhood in order to be one with us. I think the ability to invite as they are and are not and is an essential part of Godhood. There is room for all and to spare. There is love and forgiveness and acknowledgement for all and to spare. There is enough for all and to spare. That is what God offers. I'm not referring to a group hug type of oneness or a why can't we all get along type of oneness. The oneness of the atonement requires a much deeper commitment than a nice feeling or a positive attitude. It is not condoning or agreeing with someone. Being at one is an acknowledgement of connection and of being. Can we as humans begin to experience the connection God has to each of us, that God wants us to have for each other? Here are some manifestations of that, I think, in the world. Mother Teresa created a house where the dying can go. And the only purpose of it was that people who were dying could be there and have someone with them, that no one died alone. And there are volunteers, groups of volunteers, that travel from all over the world to be a part of this, to be there and just be one of the volunteers there that helps make this house work. And they come for a minimum of, they're supposed to come for a minimum of 2 months at a time. But many times when these groups come, quite a few of the people have to leave within a few days. They cannot handle just being there with people. They cannot handle just letting people be who they are. And in this place, it's letting them be someone who is dying, who is leaving this world. They want to fix them. They want to somehow make them live. They want to somehow make them whole in their own mind. And so they can't be there. Because what she asks is that they let them be where they're at. And part of that is just letting them complete who they are in that moment. And then another example is the life of Gandhi. I really like the movie that came out about Gandhi about a little over 20 years ago. And I know it's not exactly historically accurate, but quite a bit of it is. And there's a scene in that movie where Gandhi has been fasting because there's violence between the Hindus and the Muslims. And so he fasts as a way of expressing his commitment that this violence end. And he is fasting to the point of death. And he refuses to stop his fast until people see that this violence will not work. And finally, the leaders of different groups come and make a promise. They lay their weapons down and they make a promise that the violence will stop and it will not start again. And a man comes through the group up to Gandhi, and he throws bread at him, and he says, "Eat. I'm going to hell, but I don't want you on my soul." And Gandhi says, "Why are you going to hell?" And he says, I killed people because they killed my son." And he is a Hindu, and they had killed his son. So he went and he had killed Muslims. And he says, "I know I'm going to hell, but they killed my son." And Gandhi says, "I know a way where you can escape hell. Go out and find a little boy, a boy whose parents were killed, and raise him as your own. But make sure that the boy you find is Muslim, and raise him as a Muslim. And make sure he lives completely as a Muslim." And in that moment, there is this realization from this Hindu man that he truly does have a choice, that he really can create a life out of hell and a life without hate. This kind of at-one-ment can only come from a deep commitment, one that is not stopped by fear or dependent on what you feel like today. I think it offers a glimpse of what being one heart with God can provide. Not an easy life, but one that makes a difference. Consider this. If there is anywhere you are not at one, then you are not at one anywhere. If I choose to be upset and separate from my husband, I cannot live my commitment of creating peace in the world. If I cannot acknowledge and be at one with those of a different culture, and that might be a fundamentalist Muslim in Afghanistan or a conservative Mormon in Salt Lake City who thinks Sunstone is evil, then I cannot be completely at one with my children or with God. We could take on the commitment of being at one everywhere, through all time. Imagine the difference in the world if all Israelis chose to be at one heart with Ishmael and all his descendants, or if all Palestinians chose to be at one heart with Isaac and all his descendants. Who is it that you cannot imagine being one with? And are you willing to let that keep you from being one with God? In Doctrine and Covenants 38:27, if ye are not one, ye are not mine. How is the earth wasted at his coming if we are not connected? I don't think the earth is laid to waste, but we are. We chose this life together. We are here to be together. It is impossible to be born into this world without others. God constantly invites us to return to one. Otherwise, this life is wasted. If we don't choose to be at one, we cannot welcome Christ or respond to his coming. This is not some kind of punishment. It is just a statement of cause and effect. The good news of the gospel tells us it is completely in our power. It is our choice, not our circumstances, that makes us one. This choice takes us into a realm of what God promises is possible, the realm of Godhood itself. Thank you. Are we supposed to have discussion time or questions?
If there are any questions.
Okay. Questions? Thanks, Mom. Yes.
A question, really, but I think silence is that's such a profound paper of yours. I've been enlightened in ways I had no expectation about, and I'm sitting here sort of stunned and mulling over what you said. And a new way of looking at old scriptures that I've had a big thing for as long as I can remember. And I'm just sitting here amazed and processing. So it's not anything to do with that. I would hope others have the same response, but I'm trying to digest this. And you have put... And for me, you have put your finger on a response that I'm going to be proposing later on today in my paper. So I'm just sitting here in wonder. Thank you.
Thank you. I hope the digesting doesn't conflict with your breakfast.
No, it's making it go down a little easier.
Good. Any other comments, questions? In the blue shirt, and then Catherine. Or I could repeat what you say. Go ahead.
You mentioned being at one with one another and everything. From your own personal standpoint, how do you know whether you are at one or not? Thank you.
I don't worry about knowing. Knowing doesn't make any difference. When I am upset or angry, whether it's with one person or an entire group of people, I can usually know exactly why I am upset and angry and exactly what would need to happen to overcome that or get beyond it. Knowing is not what makes the difference. It really is being. And the being that I look for that creates connection is just acknowledging that who they are is who they are, and who they're not is who they're not. And it's no more or less valid than who I am and who I'm not. And in that moment, that's when I can get that I'm connected. Usually what I've started to look for is what I call red flags. And that is whenever I feel like I just can't be around someone. And that's a red flag that I'm not at one or I'm not connected. And so in that moment, all I can do is just have a choice. Do I want to be uncomfortable with that? Do I want to turn away from them? Do I want to somehow condemn? Or am I willing to consider that there is some connection, even if the only connection I can come up with is that we're both descended from the same God, whatever we call that God. And sometimes that's the only connection I can come up with. Yeah. Oh, sorry, Catherine's next, Bob.
First of all, I think that Gene England would be very proud of his daughter today, as we all are. And it's nice to have echoes of his heart and mind and voice here today. As you were talking, Jody, it seemed to me that the at-one-ment we seek has to begin with an at-one-ment with ourselves, that it's difficult and perhaps impossible to be at one with others and with the world and with our enemies, with anyone, if we don't have personal coherence, if we ourselves are fractured or divided by lack of integrity or of all of the other things that keep us from being whole. And it seems to me, and I'd be interested in your comment on this, that the reason Jesus was always able to respond immediately to anyone, whether it was out of love or anger or disappointment or whatever, was that he was always a completely integrated being at one with himself, and being at one with himself made it possible for him to offer that at-one-ment with others.
Thank you. Oh, and thanks for this. I definitely think that is the case. If we cannot, at the very least, be with who we are for who we are and who we are not, it is very difficult to go beyond that. And again, you know, the red flags are there's this constant, you know, if I am constantly feeling that there's something wrong with me, that I can't quite get it right, I'm in no position to be at one with anything. So yes, I definitely think that is the case. And in fact, you can carry that over and see that, you know, the same thing that I said about if there is anywhere that you are not at one, then you're not at one anywhere. And it's the same thing as it is if there is anyone you do not love anyone. Because there is this act of integrity about love and about being at one. And if there is any place where it is out of integrity, it's never completely in integrity. And yet, that is exactly what we're told we can do, is be in complete integrity of being love everywhere with everyone, being at one everywhere with everyone. And it happens in a moment. Because a lot of times the attitude is, how am I ever going to get to where I can work my way through loving everyone? It's either there or it's not. And you choose it or you don't. And so it isn't a process of working over years. It's just a process of practicing having it in place or not. Yes. Catherine, aren't you going to say anything?
Shining bright.
Yeah, oh, okay.
Your story of Gandhi brought to mind a recent TV show that I was watching. Morgan Spurlock has a TV show called 30 Days. And the first one is where he invites people back to.
He asks people, yeah, the Super Size Me guy, he has a show where he asks people to take something on for 30 days.
And in the first episode, he has a conservative Christian from West Virginia go and live with a and as a Muslim within a community of Muslims in Wisconsin.
I think so.
And there are kind of rules that he dresses and just kind of does the actions. He doesn't have to believe as a Muslim. But the thing he struggles with is he cannot bring himself to join in prayer with the Muslims, and he struggles with this for weeks until he, towards the end, the show kind of shows this is kind of the main thing, until he finally is able to accept that he can join in prayer with the Muslim worship. And it's just, it was very moving, and I realized that it's not a matter of just tolerance, it's a matter of could you join in prayer with the Muslim? And that if we could join in prayer with Muslims, that would lead to world peace, I think.
Yeah.
It brought to mind what you were saying about Gandhi and the women, you join in prayer and with the Muslims.
And I think the place that we tend to go is that would somehow be saying that that's the right way and what we've been doing is the wrong way. And that's not it at all. It's just letting it be what it is. Can we just join in it for what it is? And we don't have to give up our prayer for it. It's just acknowledging theirs. And an amazing experience. Yeah, I agree. I think that is world peace.
Thank you, Jody. I'm sure that gave us all very much to think about. Our time is up. Recordings of this session will be available later in the morning if you would like them. Thank you for attending.